One and all to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio and incidentally the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. And we've been enjoying our great new time slot here. And for those of you who are new to listening to the show, don't worry, I'm sure the FCC will take us off air soon enough. Now, I'd like to say a good hello to my fabulous co-host, Will, who unfortunately has not been with us the last 2 days. Will, how's it going, man?
Good, mate. Glad to be back. And hello out there to our new listeners and our new slot. And some of our old listeners, too, I hope.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And for those of you who are listening live on the streams at AmericanFreedomRadio.com, check out the great sponsors as well. Now, apparently, I've got a few articles to run through here. World Bank quietly funding a massive corporate water grab. And that doesn't sound too good. And billions have been spent allowing corporations to profit from public water sources, even though water privatization has been an epic failure in Latin America, Southeast Asia, North America, Africa, and everywhere else it's been tried. But don't tell that to controversial loan sharks at the World Bank. Last month, its private sector funding arm, International Finance Corporation, the IFC, quietly dropped a cool 100 million euros on Veolia Voda, the Eastern European subsidiary of Veolia, who, incidentally, now have control over Auckland's water in New Zealand here. Isn't that right? Now, the world's largest water corporation and its latest target is the privatization of Eastern Europe's water resources. And it just goes to me to show that there's just a resource grab going on, right? These scumbags are really, really pushing it home hard, methinks. And goodness knows what they've got planned next. I think it'll probably be nice, lovely, something nice and easy to deal with, you know, like a oppressive police state or 24/7 surveillance of activists and community leaders, shutting down of protests, you know, something nice like that. And old Barack H. O'Barry is returning to the homeland that referred to him as Barry in Jakarta in Indonesia. And the two houses where he spent part of his boyhood stand pretty much the way they did when he went back to Hawaii 4 decades ago. And the two schools he attended have grown larger, but in spirit remain unchanged. Some of his old friends can still be found around the neighbourhood. And near one of his homes there, the same family still runs a wooden stall selling gado-gado, an Indonesian salad covered in peanut sauce. Isn't that lovely? Oh, Barry, you've returned home to us after all these madrasa years. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. And we'll be right back after the break.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will. I am Will, and Vinny is somewhere. We have a guest joining us today, Chris Van Ryn from Kiora Gaza. And apparently we do. Apparently we don't. Maybe we have a guest from.
We're having a bit of trouble connecting him up, but you know, I'm sure eventually he'll be able to come on. but yeah, what they've been getting up to, they were part of this 500 vehicle convoy, right? That was trying to breach the old blockade of Gaza. To get in some food, some medical supplies, building materials, that kind of thing. It was a pretty massive spectacle. We attempted to get them up during the actual march itself, but apparently communication in the Middle East ain't that easy, especially when you're traveling around in an enormous friggin' convoy. But yeah. I would be considered that anybody who really kind of tries to get their stuff together and try and help out others around this world deserves to be supported at least in some way. But, you know, it's difficult for me because the Israel-Palestinian conflict there, it seems to be impossible to work out. Right, everybody keeps talking about this Middle East peace process, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's just kind of like this big lever that gets used by administrations to just, you know, win votes at the least and perhaps, you know, support the old Zionist regime. And it's sickening to me, really, that the majority of the population, particularly in the United States, are unaware, you know? There's nothing going on in this world that happens by accident, by and large, right? And if they're manipulating the population through their media propaganda and whatnot, then what chance do the rest of us stand about getting decent information out? You know, it just barely even happens. Go ahead.
Well, here's my cynicism, Vinny. Here's the real cynicism. You know, I firmly believe that. Well, I don't just believe. I know they use crises in order to rally us behind their causes. But I think protracting a so-called peace process or a war process in the Middle East and in the disputed territories around Gaza is the ultimate sort of It's the ultimate excuse for Westerners to go look over there at the problems, and not be aware of what's right under their noses, not care about what's in their food and what's in their water and what their local government's doing. You know, and so it's a feel good thing for the left, and the fake right play into it too by supporting the other side by default, and it's kind of. You know, it just supports as long as you can look somewhere else. You know, if you're enslaved like a some cop is serving the government who gets treated like crap too. As long as you can deal out dirt on someone else, you're satisfied. And similarly, as long as a lot of the left marching around, you know, working like slaves around us, as long as they can see someone else is more enslaved, they're happy. And that's at a base level, that's really what I think this whole, you know, feel good thing. We're going to go help Africa. We're going to go help Palestinians. We're going to go help, you know, Malaysians or whoever. That's what it's all about, because there's people right next to you who need help. You need help. You know? And so that's my ultimate cynicism. We don't need to go anywhere else. If we all looked after ourselves and our own communities, everything would be just fine.
My consideration is the Palestinians have been under the jackboot of Nazi Israeli occupation, slaughter. I mean, sorry, for quite some time. I don't think they're even really capable of fighting back against them. I mean, what are we up against? The fourth biggest military in the world?
They're totally capable.
Yeah, they're totally capable, and they get killed 100 to 1, bro. I mean, what was it?
Can you stand up against your oppressive government? What would happen if you stood up against... Exactly, you'd get killed 100 to 1. So we're in the same situation, so we don't need to go, you know what I mean? This is the whole problem. We're in exactly the same situation, but just with a slightly higher standard of living, you know?
Yeah, basically that's the key to it, isn't it? Well, you know, if you've gotten used to having a nice little cushy kind of society, then, you know, you don't feel like resisting anything, really, do you? You kind of go, oh, well, you know, can't be that bad, and everybody becomes a frickin' relativist all of a sudden.
Yeah. If you've got the basic essentials covered, even if it is poison, food, and water, people are happy.
And why are we happy? I mean, I was thinking about satisfaction itself, you know, politically. What's going on here in our society, right?
If there was no Middle East and we were the bottom of the heap and nothing was different other than the fact that there was no Middle East and the hardship there and no Africa and the hardship there, people would actually start doing things about our own situation we're currently in. But because they've got that as a comparison and because they're relativist, they don't do anything about their own situation. You know,
yeah, it's true. I mean, people have to take responsibility for their own actions and their own government. And I'm just kind of thinking, well, resistance is not futile, is it? No matter how big and bad your enemy is, as long as you actually decide to resist, that is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yes, and we're joined by our special guest, Chris Van Ryn of Kia Ora Gaza. Chris, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will.
Vinny, how are you? Thanks for having me. A few little hiccups there before we got online. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no, don't worry. It's my fault. I'm a technically inept mofo at the best of times. Now, come on.
Yeah, I'm dyslexic.
Yeah, well, you said that you wanted to come on air and spin us a few yarns, mate, about your travels. Go on, break it down for us.
Well, I've had a few experiences, you know, just to remind the audience of what I was involved with. We started our convoy to supply humanitarian aid to Gaza, which started off in London, Luton, where we had a whole lot of vehicles loaded with medical aid, drove down into France, down into Italy, across the water to Greece, drove into Istanbul, which was suicidal, through Istanbul, Turkey, and right up into Syria, where we got holed up in a refugee camp there, a Palestinian refugee camp that was unused. We holed ourselves up there for 15 days while we negotiated entry into Al Arish. It's the Egyptian port there. We shipped all our vehicles there by sea. And then we drove a short distance to Gaza and spent 3 or 4 days there delivering aid.
And what kind of opposition did you have during this convoy? I mean, did you have any Israeli tank forces, you know, saying, shalom?
No. We had, actually, the opposition was predominantly the Egyptian authorities. Thinking back a bit, you know, we got into Israel, to Istanbul there, and surprisingly didn't find a very supportive government there. We were escorted by police for most of our time there, in fact, through Turkey. And then in Syria, we had a very supportive government. The problems really came in Al Arish, in Egypt. We were under very tight security there, the Egyptian army and the riot police. But apart from the security and the watchful eye, we didn't really encounter any problems. and were able to drive straight through into Rafah and then into Gaza with our ambulances. So that was perhaps a testimony to the good communication that people had had between Cairo and our management of the Viva Palestina convoy, Kevin Ovendeen, and of course the illustrious George Galloway. 18 of whom were banned, actually, from the convoy. We had to let go 18 people who were restricted from entry into Egypt. So the resistance was more diplomatic at government level. And once inside Gaza, we were very strictly managed by the Hamas for our protection, and that really didn't allow us a freedom of movement very much inside Gaza for the 3 nights and 4 days that we were there. So all in all, no real trouble anywhere along the way, although a preparedness for it. As the ship was on the water in international waters, they were followed by Israeli ships, but they were out there on the horizon, and apart from a lot of hiss and wind and a lot of puff they made prior to us getting on the water, they didn't really involve themselves with it at all. So we had a smooth entry, Vinny, right through into Gaza.
Much more successful than the last flotilla attempt, yes?
More successful than the last flotilla attempt, and more successful than the last land convoy, which also had riots with the Egyptian police at the time, which really resulted in fisticuffs and lots of batons going up and down. And I think that really paved the way for us. Though flotilla caused a tremendous amount of conversation and controversy on the trip. Everyone knows what happened there, I think. For those who don't, 9, now 10 people were killed on that ship, humanitarian aid workers. 56 were injured. And a lot of people, including Kevin Ovendeen and Nicola Inchmarch, who were on our convoy, suffered post-traumatic stress. So, regrettably, that kind of paved the way for a turning point in the way the Egyptian authorities managed us. And I think a sign towards the movement of that country to align itself more with the cause of the Palestinians in the world today. So I think it was a shift in the positive direction.
And it's ironic, really, that terrible incidents like that where humanitarian aid workers are killed has to lead to something positive, you know? I mean, can't positive things lead to positive other things? No, somebody's got to get shot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we debated this several times, you know? It's like, can you actually make a significant change without any violence entering into the scene? And, you know, one discussion I had as little as yesterday was with someone from United Nations. It was, well, we can take a Gandhian approach to resistance. You know, we all stand there and let ourselves be hit without resisting. And that, in a way, is something that everyone might aspire to, a non-violent resisting approach. But his observation was, is that chances are that would never get in the news. And that's the tragedy of it all, really, that only violence in dramatic terms seems to actually get on the news to create any form of awareness and publicity around the situation. And that's exactly what the Mavi Marmara did achieve at the cost of those lives. It paved the way for us to bring our 150 vehicles with $7 million worth of aid in 30 countries into Gaza, really without a hiccup. So it was quite amazing.
Now, you said 150 vehicles. I was under the impression that it was closer to 500. Was there any complications with the amount of funding or things about the convoy setting off?
Yeah, there were. There were lots of complications, and you're quite right. What we discovered when we went to London was that the Pakistan situation had dramatically affected both volunteers and finance around the situation. And in a way, it's perfectly understandable. You know, that was a really serious and still is situation that humanitarian aid workers and funds from all over the world had been diverted to. And the other major difference, the major influence on it, was that people were absolutely terrified to join the convoy. You know, the deaths on the Mavi Marmara were a great cause of concern for a lot of humanitarian aid workers. So kind of at the 11th hour, we lost a lot of people and a lot of funding towards that situation. And I can understand that. The fact that it was smaller was, for me personally, very disappointing, but it nevertheless did not take away from the fact that when we drove our 150 vehicles with 30 countries there, when we drove through that border post Mavi Marmara, we really put a peg in the ground to say to the world that activists from around the world won't be put off by arrogant, brutal treatment of humanitarian aid workers, especially off the back of the United Nations declaration about what Israel had done, which was tantamount to an act of piracy. It was really saying to the world, you know, we're not prepared to put up with humanitarian aid workers, but we still managed to get 400 people and 150 vehicles across the line. So I think that's a credit to everybody.
Indeedy do. And my consideration of this is that it's a double whammy, right? Said the Gazans to the Israeli soldiers. welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. Our very special guest is Chris Van Ryn from Kia Ora Gaza. For those of you who don't speak Māori, Kia Ora means hello in Māori. And you were just telling us over the break about the general convoy stages, and you jumped on a few ships in Italy and sailed across to Greece and cruised on through to Istanbul, driving on through, and you're stopping in the towns and cities and parading around and that kind of thing, handing out leaflets and talking with the local populations. What kind of a reception were you getting there, Chris?
Oh, Vinny, it was overwhelming. Overwhelming, really, in every sense of the world. It wasn't something that I expected, but we had tremendous support from the very first stop we made in France, which is in a municipal town called Bagnolet, where the local population, including Palestinian refugees, but also local population, came out to welcome us in an official parade. So we drove through a corridor of people, and it was the mark of the first of many of those sorts of parades throughout our entire journey. And they put us up in a large sports hall where we all camped down in that sports hall. They provided us with food. In fact, I didn't personally buy a meal on the whole trip. It wasn't required because everywhere we went, we were really well looked after. They gave us a lot of aid along the way, clothes, equipment, medical aid. And as we neared Turkey, the closer we got, the more support we received, so that by the time we got to Istanbul, it was a major event with Al Jazeera Television, BBC, and the rest of the TV crews there. We really felt like celebrities. It was the first time I've ever been treated that way, and I felt quite embarrassed about it, to be honest with you. It was quite overwhelming to be greeted with people who would hug and weep and cry, you know, just in front of you, with their gratitude at what it was that we were doing. It was very empowering. I felt quite humbled by it. I didn't actually think I deserved it. But that's the way we got treated right through to Syria, where, in fact, in Syria, they must have served us in the vicinity of 4,000 or 5,000 meals during the time that we were there for the 15 days. And we had tremendous reception from the people there, as well as the local Palestinian community. Egypt was a little less welcoming, of course. We were escorted one by one into vehicles and into our accommodation. But Gaza, as you can imagine, was just, well, how can I put it? It was a corridor of people from the border into the city centre, often held back by Hamas soldiers. But we drove through a crowd of people that had worked themselves up into a frenzy by the thousands there who would reach in and try and touch you, and they would greet us with, you know, welcome to Gaza, welcome to Gaza, thank you for coming. Their gratitude was palpable. It was there in your hands to see and feel. And if anybody wants to feel rewarded about a convoy such as this, that really is the time when you reach out and touch somebody's hand and know that you've affected their lives in a very dramatic way. You also know that what you're doing is very worthwhile right there at that moment. And so that was the kind of the culmination of the chapter of liberating Palestine, really, for me. It was a fabulous event.
And as far as... Oh, mate, and it sounds like there's a lot of support out there. And my theory is that, of course, there's been a lot of media coverage of the Palestinian issue over quite some period of years, namely because the conflict never gets resolved. And my concern is, though, that... you know, being here in New Zealand, I heard Zippo about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I, because that was my role, endeavoured time and time again to connect with media here. We had a good reception with TV3 and to a degree with TV1, although less so. But it was extremely difficult for us to get footage back to New Zealand. We really didn't have the financial capacity as a voluntary organization, non-profit organization, to send via satellite the film over. And the television companies, at the end of the day, weren't prepared to fund it for us. I did take footage, but couldn't get it out there. We had some conversations with some of the radio stations here, but you know what? It was very limp. It was the sort of usual kind of superficial stuff from them all, really, and it didn't provide... Really, what it did was discredit the listener. It dumbed it down and just made me feel that what they were trying to tell people... Well, they weren't trying to tell people anything. It was a waste of energy. So it wasn't as good a coverage as we might have hoped. Certainly, even when we got into Gaza, I was in real-time contact with them, and we just couldn't get the support that was required. On the Kia Ora Gaza website, mind you, we had something like 200 real-time viewers as we texted information back as we entered Gaza, because it was, for us, a historic moment. And that has received some 8,000, possibly now up to about 16,000 hits since the time that website was started, which has been up about... perhaps 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks. Oh, perhaps more now, actually, because it started just before the convoy. I forget that we were away for 7 weeks. So I think what you're doing and other non-mainstream media is the media of force in the world today. We simply bypass mainstream media. It doesn't do the job, and it won't do the job, so we'll get out there and do it ourselves, like you're doing, Vinny, and many of the other Facebook sites and the other non-traditional forms of media. And that message came actually through very strongly by the likes of the VP, that's the Viva Palestina management, George Galloway. It's very much a movement to blogs, Facebook, Twitter, you know, all those other networking sites and the non-stream media, which are really getting out the messages that need to be told to the people out there.
Well, as far as I know, Israel has incredibly large amounts of influence over mainstream media. In the United States, for example, you can't air any story on mainstream media regarding the Palestine conflict or Israel unless it goes through several, media lobby groups, basically. Just say, hey, look, we've got Israelis slaughtering Palestinians for no reason over here. That's not good. What we're going to do is say that the Palestinians blew up one Israeli and then they were retaliating, okay?
Yeah. Well, the problem is, The problem is that they're classing it as offensive material now, even. And so you can't offend anyone, and, you know, Yahoo's passing those commercial laws of their own where, you know, you can't write any comments, you can't blog on sites offending people, you know, under their control. It's become like free speech is now curtailed by, you know, you can't hurt people's feelings, which was never a definition.
This is in Israel, Will, or all around the world?
This is all around the world. I mean, this is what media and the controlling forces behind the internet are trying to do. They're trying to say no one can really offend anyone in a broadcast sense or in a media sense. And so if you bring up a certain point of view about Israel or the whole conflict there, you're going to offend one side or another, right? In an open definition, so they'll say, hey.
You know, fascinating, as a slight digression from what you're saying, where when we were in France, one of the MPs was in the process of being taken to court for wearing a T-shirt that said "Boycott Israel Goods," and that was a big thing for us on the convoy when we realised that. It was like, you know, to be taken to court for wearing a T-shirt that says "Boycott Israel." No free speech, no. And I happen to be a very offensive person, so I think I'm going to be right in line for the firing squad here by the sounds of it.
Nice.
Well, the ADL go after people, don't they? I mean, they're known for it. The ADL support, you know, Nazis like Adolf Hitler. Nazis like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Whilst they go after people who just voice their concerns, like, David Icke. And I don't know if George Galloway has come to attention, but I'd imagine so with some of the things I've heard him say. You know, Galloway's very outspoken.
He is very outspoken.
It's just a dangerous road to take, is it not, when we start saying, you know, you can't have free speech if other people could interpret it as offensive.
Yeah. And, of course, the interpretation can be very loose too. And on that note, and again, a slight digression, I was talking to a person yesterday from the United Nations Association of New Zealand who informs me that there is no recognised definition of the word terrorism, which effectively means that the word can be bandied around as anybody sees fit to classify anybody. In this case, of course, the Hamas are classified as a terrorist organisation. But the fact is that nobody has defined it at this point. There's no, according to him, there's no definition of the word. And I'm wondering whether that, in actual fact, is convenient for a lot of people, because they can throw that word at almost anybody they choose to in a form of propaganda to discredit one group against others.
Exactly. Well, exactly. But at least it means that we can call Mossad terrorists, right?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah, the total terrorism. And my favourite definition of terrorism is it's a form of government. You know, and taking that as the definition, if you're taking that as the definition, then, Israel is the very definition of a terrorist government, aren't they? I mean, how much terror goes on there? Quite a bit, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
The banks are terrorists. The insurance companies are terrorists. You know, how far do we want to go here? But they love open, loose definitions of things, because just like Al Qaeda, you know, it's just such an open thing. Al Qaeda, Taliban, you know, fundamentalist Islam, you know, and so they can just use these open-ended terms and have these mysterious boogeymen infinitely, really, because. Yeah, and that's what they want. They want a carte blanche excuse to just go in and do what they want.
Yes. I was thinking, Vinny, it might be interesting for your listeners to hear about a ground report, so to speak, of what's going on in Gaza. And just to draw a bit of a distinction here, Gaza is in a slightly different situation from the West Bank, which effectively is operating as an apartheid situation where there are Israeli roads and Palestinian roads or Arab roads. There are checkpoints all over the place so that a a 15-minute journey can end up taking 3 or 4 hours at the cost of many lives, in the sense that, you know, pregnant women can be held up at borders and lose babies, which is literally what is happening on a regular basis there. Gaza in itself, of course, is under siege. It has a practical wall and a theoretical wall around it. It is prevented economically from being self-sustainable because there is no outflow of any goods and no incoming goods apart from a small amount to sustain them, in other words, so that they don't end up looking thin and wasted, which would be against the public perception of what is reasonable. But what Israel has actually done, as I have seen with my own eyes, is waged a very strategic psychological war on Gaza. It has gone in and very carefully and systematically destroyed any form of infrastructure and ability to be self-sustainable. They've taken out police stations so that law and order breaks down. They've bombed sewage plants and water treatment plants so that there is little fresh water in the place, if any. There's a lot of contaminated water there. There is little good management of sewage. There's no reasonable power supply there. And then in addition to that, they've gone on and taken out factories.
Yep, it's a brilliant way to make sure that people can't live their lives in peace. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will. And our special guest is Chris Van Ryn from Kia Ora Gaza. And we'll be right back after the break.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
We don't know the way it's going to go. And speaking of which, our very special guest, Chris Van Ryn from Kia Ora Gaza, has been joining us for the first hour of today's show. And one thing I wanted to get into was the get a little bit of empathy out there and talking about contrast, right? When I walk out of my house and go on the street, you know, I see electricity's working, water's running, the roads are upkept, there's police, there's general public order, there's a stable government, there's a stable food supply, I can go out and buy stuff if I want to. And Chris, I'm acting under the assumption that this is not the this is not the case in Gaza.
Look, I tell you what, Vinny, one of the most remarkable things for me when I got back to New Zealand was the fact that I could have a drink of fresh water, that I could lie in a bed, that I could go to a toilet where when I flushed it didn't run around my ankles, and that I'd had a hot shower. And for 5 of the 7 weeks that I was on my convoy in some of the Middle Eastern countries, and particularly in places like Gaza, those basic things that we've come to take for granted, they're just simply not there. And when you don't have them, you really start to appreciate what it's like to have what we've got are great luxuries in our country. Fresh water, a sewage system that works, and a hot shower and a clean bed. That's not the case in Gaza. And more than that, they're actually under constant psychological trauma. The threat that at any moment, F-16s can come overhead and launch an attack the way they did a couple of years ago, is always with them. A lot of the local people are, of course, not in control of the odd rocket that heads back the other way in their quest for self-determination. But every time it happens, they know that they can expect some out of proportion, a disproportionate force from Israel. So I think a really good way for New Zealanders to come to understand what it's like in Gaza and what it has been like is to draw the analogy with what happened in Christchurch. There, the city has the effect of an earthquake. Some buildings come down. That's exactly what it was like in Gaza. all of a sudden, the rest of New Zealand is sympathising with what's happened in Christchurch. It's like, will we have power? Rain is going to come into our house. Our chimney's fallen over. There are shelters put up for people to go and get food. People don't go to work anymore. There's a general concern about where are we going to stay and is this going to happen again? And suddenly, major companies in New Zealand and banks are pouring money into Christchurch to attend to that. And of course, that's quite right. But this is the situation that is very similar to what it is like in Gaza. You know, they're on cleanup mode, but there have been bomb buildings there. There are people who work in the fields that get picked off by Israeli soldiers at random. In fact, one of the jobs, if any of your listeners are keen, you might like to partake in this too, Vinny, is you go and stand alongside one of the workers there picking olives, because if there's a Westerner alongside them, they don't get shot. So in a way, you're like a body shield for them.
A human shield.
A human shield, yeah.
And that, so you don't get shot while you're doing... Just so you don't get shot while you're doing that dangerous, terrible terrorist activity of picking olives.
Precisely. Precisely. And if you think that's just talk, well, I was there, and when I raised my camera to take a shot from a car window, there was pandemonium inside the car, because this was actually looking out towards the Israeli border, which was a speck in the distance of a tank running along the road there. I mean, it was the size of a matchbox as far as I was concerned. But when I raised my camera to take a shot of the land in between, which had been razed by phosphorus bombs, I was really left with no doubt that we had to move. We couldn't stay there as a stationary vehicle and certainly not raise the camera, because they might interpret that as an attack and pop you off. So this is real life for them every day. They're gradually in a process of reconstruction. They don't have the raw materials to do it, so they're a model of recycling. They break everything that's been bombed down into small bits and they reuse it in every which way possible. So maybe that gives people a bit of an idea of what it's like in Gaza. And I suspect that it's a lot worse in the West Bank, in the sense that they are checkpointed and controlled their every move. At least within Gaza, you have relatively unrestrained movement within that small strip of land. It isn't going very far. It's about the size of Auckland, I think, perhaps a little smaller. So it's traumatic conditions that they grow up in, that they live in. And really, the Western world needs to get in behind a huge shift. They need to get in behind and push to free the Palestinians from their ordeal, as we know it today.
Yes, all right. And thank you very much, Chris, for coming on the show with us today. Have you got a website or something that people can keep up with your efforts?
Yep, there is. There's the Kia Ora Gaza website, kiaoragaza.net. They can go there and have a look at the organisation that is continuing to send people and arrange funding for various things in Gaza. There's my own blog, cvrjourneyjourney.blogspot.com. People can see photos of Gaza there and read reports on what is happening there from my own personal perspective as a photojournalist and writer. So thank you for that, Vinny, and thank you, Will, and we'll look forward to talking to you again sometime.
All right, thank you very much. There he goes, ladies and gentlemen, Chris Van Ryn from Kia Ora Gaza. Very appreciative of having him on the show today. Now, it just goes to show you that despite the fact that we're real anti-New World Order on this show, it turns out that the globalized society that we live in has a kind of global resistance element to it as well. So in essence, the New World Order itself has created its own resistance against itself, which I find absolutely spectacular and, well, quite fabulous, you know? There's no point standing down to tyrants, because after all, they don't stop their bulldozers or stop their death machine to let you through. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll be right back after the break with hour number two. Oh, yes, we're back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio. Now, there's something to be said about issues like the Palestinian conflict, and quite frankly, it's a mainstream issue, all right? And, you know, we don't generally discuss a terribly large amount of mainstream issues, but like we know in this movement here, the truth movement, that there's an awful lot of elements that don't get discussed around these mainstream issues, and I've asked Will if he might actually fill us in a little bit about the kind of things to do with the Palestinian-Israel conflict that just aren't talked about.
Well, you know, I don't consider myself an authority on this subject, but there are issues that aren't that well known, and one of those big ones is the fact that Mossad, if you look into the whole history of it and the individuals involved, was responsible for creating Hamas. And so even the Palestinian resistance, which may have elements of sort of altruistic resistance, genuine Palestinian resistance, was contrived by the Israelis. And people say, well, why would they want to do that? Well, in the same way that the US and the British pushed Islamic radicalism and financed groups such as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and of course trained people, anyone from Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, Osama bin Laden. And so they create enemies, and likewise Israeli created enemies in order to bring in an oppressive sort of state of their own on their own people, and it's about attacking their own people. And for those of you who don't believe that, then I refer you to the 1951 incident where about 100,000 children were pushed through a ringworm program where they irradiated them at up to 35,000 times a recommended radiation dosage. Remember, in 1951, there was medical knowledge of the effects of radiation. In fact, going back to the 30s and 40s, there was definite knowledge on the effects of radiation. And so just like the troops they irradiated and everyone else, they decided to, kill about 6,000 children at the time or soon after, irradiating them at 35,000 times a dosage, telling their parents they'll be treated for ringworm on the scalp. But they targeted Sephardic ethnic Jewish kids only. I mean, this was an attack on their own people. This was financed, 6 million liras, in fact, financed by the US government. And specific X-ray machines were given to them also by that government in 1951. I'm sorry, it was six times the health budget. Sorry, it was about 300 million liras. Yeah. Incredible. And, no one says anything about this. This was a Holocaust of sorts after, you know, that of the Nazis only a few years earlier. They didn't learn anything. They don't care.
And what I find interesting is that people say that if you're against Israel, then you're anti-Semitic. And they don't realize that being a Jew doesn't mean anything racial. It's actually a religion. That's why they call it Judaism, okay? I'm not anti-Semitic because I'm anti-slaughter of innocent people.
And most Semites, remember, are not in Israel and are not Jewish. You see, it's a different, it's a whole different categorization. We've got into this before, but, you know, people forget all too easily, and they just, you know, they are the anti-Semites. They are the ones who hate Jews, in fact, because they don't even know who they are.
Yep. Best way to make sure that your enemy gets all the bad attention is to call them what you are. You're a Nazi, and I'm a Jew. We'll be right back, folks.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road. When along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to win a muckamack with me, you can ride.
Thank you. Sam, how's it going, mate?
Good, Vinny. Always good to speak to you. And, of course, also, I guess, speaking to your American listeners as well.
Indeedy do. Welcome, one and all. I wanted to talk about something very specific with you, Tim, because we've got some, what would you say, incredibly scary stuff going on with investigative journalism legislation here in New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's this new bill that they're trying to put through. I mean, search and surveillance bill that they've been in the New Zealand Parliament trying it on, basically, to see how far they can push it. And basically, I know the news item you're referring to here is that one of New Zealand's top investigative journalists has expressed his doubts about the legislation, and that what it will do is, in his words, hog tie, I think, the investigative journalists, because it will force disclosure to the police of a journalist's sources. And in a democracy, and certainly in the United States, I mean, that's taken very, very seriously, because it undermines the role of a free press. It undermines the basic whistleblowing nature of exposing corruption wherever it may be, but specifically in government circles. And that's the major cause for concern with this legislation. My other cause for concern is that it basically, the way it's written, it gives the New Zealand police, and there's also a provision that it might actually extend to other agencies of state, it gives them basically a three-day fishing expedition to go and plant bugs and do whatever they want, right, surveillance-wise, covertly, without any judicial oversight, without any form of application being made at all. And basically it is a fishing expedition for 3 days. They can do whatever they want, and if they don't get any result, well, then I suppose I think the legislation says at the moment they have to declare it, that, well, it's 3 days, nothing happened. Or it's 3 days later and we'll go, because now they've gone on their fishing expedition, right, Vinny? They've got the information that they need to secure or at least continue their investigation. And then so armed with that, they will then go to the Justice of the Peace or in our system, a deputy registrar at the court, a judicial officer, and get it signed off, basically, that they can continue this covert surveillance. And the problem is, of course, that this three-day thing is absolutely ridiculous. There's no way. I mean, it is quite literally a license to go fishing. It's a three-day fishing expedition for the cops, and it's outrageous, really. I mean, the cops have to have the evidence to start with, don't they? And then go to the judicial authorities to get it signed off, because the fact is, in a democracy, well, in any country, really, I mean, we just do not trust the police or any other organisation for that matter to go on these spying expeditions. And
well, I'm concerned about what about articles written about corruption in the police force, and then the police get them to reveal their sources.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is the thing, is that will be used to cover things up and shut things down. And in New Zealand, we have a whistleblower legislation that does protect, under some circumstances, state officials who want to, or other officials, other people who want to disclose potential criminal acts, negligence, et cetera, against the organisation that they're with. And I can just see this search and surveillance bill undermining and cutting through that like a razor. And the fact is, the police have had this cooking for quite some time. They have put in provisions in the bill, and I notice, I guess it was a select committee or something before that. I mean, they've woken up to the idea that maybe they shouldn't be giving these powers to every single organisation on the statute books, like the bloody the pork board, you know, and the housing corporation or whatever, having these rights of search and surveillance that shouldn't be given to them, and that it should be at least restricted to competent authorities.
Because like, heaven forbid somebody have some meat that isn't kosher, Tim.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, we introduced in 1989 the Serious Fraud Office. And it was needed at the time because of the 87 share market crash, and there was a lot of dodgy dealings going on there. And, of course, this has just been echoed in the recent financial collapse in 2008. But the specific thing with the Serious Fraud Office legislation was this provision that you were forced to answer questions. And it didn't apply to anything else across other crimes. It was just serious financial crimes, as in the millions of dollars, where people would be compelled to answer questions. So there was no right of silence in this legislation. And what we're seeing here is a seepage with a very powerful police force we have in this country. I don't know if you American listeners might not know, but there is only one police force in New Zealand. It's not there's no regional police forces. There's just one police force for the whole country, and that's it. And there happens to be a few suits from the Serious Fraud Office that go around with this power to compel testimony from people. Now, they want, that's a seepage here, they want to progress that into the search and surveillance bill so that now the cops, right? Now the cops have this thing that they can also compel testimony. And this is where the journalists start up in arms. Hold on a second.
This has to be like a scene from The Exorcist. The power of search and surveillance compels you. The power of search and surveillance compels you. You know?
Well, a prison, a potentially indeterminate prison sentence, Vinny, is what compels people. I mean, we had that case with Vince Seymour, didn't we? I mean, we've talked about him before, haven't we? And I think your other guest, Penny Bright, has talked about him. He's taken up cudgel. This is a case of an American citizen who was jailed in New Zealand for was contempt of court in the end, wasn't it? And he was put in there because he ran a website against certain members of the judiciary in New Zealand that he had taken great offence against, amongst other people. And I remember reading through that website. I really couldn't see anything that was that bad about it at all, really. And here was a judicial order, wasn't it, Vinny, saying that the guy had to take that website down or else he would remain in jail. I mean,
indefinitely.
Indefinitely. Which is, I mean,
and this in New Zealand, the least corrupt country on earth.
Well, tell us what's happening with that, Vinny. I hear that that Penny Bright, who I just mentioned, is on a bit of a mission there.
Oh, yeah. She's come up with a whole series of questions to ask about whether or not, you know, certain systems are going to be corrupt. It can be applied, you know, copied across any number of countries. For example, is it unlawful for politicians to knowingly misrepresent their policy? No! Is it lawful?
Well, we've just, if I could interrupt you there, Vinny, we've just had a case in the United Kingdom. Just recently, there in the last couple of days, a former, I think it was the Labour immigration minister there, Mr. Wallace, has just been convicted in the election court there of lying about another candidate. And this is a specific law in the UK, and I think we have a similar one here in New Zealand. It's in the last 2 days, right, of the election, and including and also the election day itself, you're not allowed to tell a lie, an untruth that you know is an untruth about another candidate. And I guess the rationale, Vinny, for that is that you could say any cockamamie thing you like, and there's not enough time and to refute it before the election, and it's to discourage candidates from doing that. And this Wallace chap has gotten himself into big trouble, and he's been banned for 3 years and can't re-stand. I guess he's going to appeal it, but I mean,
you know, so what would be real funny?
You actually aren't allowed to lie, but Vinny, you're only not allowed to lie 2 days before an election.
Well, what if I said that the other candidates got 3 months to live? That would discourage people from voting for him. He's got cancer.
If you truthfully believed it, if you've got some transcript from the tarot hotline or something that says he's going to cark it, I suppose you can get away with it if you really wanted to. But, I mean, that's the law. But it's interesting, isn't it, that lying is only not permissible for the politicians only within 2 days of an election.
Well, because otherwise, how the hell would they have a job any day before that or any day after that?
So what were some of the other things on this list that Penny Bright had that she was going to evidence, basically, to or propositions, I suppose, she was going to put to the so-called, what is it, the Transparency International?
Well,
what
yeah, she's going to this the meeting of Transparency International in Bangkok in Thailand. And there's going to be 1,500 people there. And Vince Seymour's printing her up 1,000 flyers that she's going to promote, you know, my website and her website and Vince's website and Uncensored and, you know, going to go out there.
I haven't
and,
paid my subs, obviously. Yes, keep going.
Well, affiliate programs, bro, come on. And basically she's got this big old list of things to talk about. I can't remember all of them off the top of my head, but interesting
ones.
But
they are very
like,
good questions, aren't they? And then they raise the spectre that this whole Transparency International thing might be a bit of a rather opaque, don't you think, in its own way, because New Zealand is supposedly, along with Denmark and wherever it happens
Singapore.
To be, Singapore. Come on, and Singapore. I have to laugh, mate. Mr. Lee, who is the Prime Minister of Singapore, his dad, Lee Kuan Yew, happened to be the former Prime Minister, the first Prime Minister of Singapore for many, many years. They call him a minister mentor now. He's still in cabinet in that role. And his son has now taken over the prime ministership. And we say, well, maybe that's normal. I mean, the Bushes, for example. Yeah, for example. I mean, you can have certain dynastic aspects to a democracy. But it just so happens that his wife happens to run Tamasek, I think it's the largest Singapore state pension fund, basically. And you get his other brother, I think it is, happens to run the military.
And let me guess, the population doesn't know about it, right? That's why they call it a corruption perception index. If it was a corruption reality index, it'd be a different story.
Well, the poor people of Singapore, I mean, they don't really have much of a choice. They ban satellite TV, basically, in Singapore. There's very limited information. So, of course, the people's perception of Singapore is going to be warped. I mean, it's basically a one-party state, the way that they've organised it. And as I said, the ruling family have got their tentacles and their people at all sorts of high positions of state. And I'm saying if you look at it objectively and you pretend, well, there isn't really a democracy if you remove that, but you're going, well, this must be a corrupt state, surely, you know?
How could it not be? It's a plutocracy,
well,
isn't it?
Well, the same thing with New Zealand. We've got all sorts of and I just mentioned that search and surveillance bill is just one aspect in which it's all going downhill rather rapidly, and yet the perception is that it isn't. Therefore, it isn't.
No, Tim. The bullet can pierce you unless you believe there's a bullet. You know, it's so funny, man. Everybody's so freaking dumb. I love socialized education, man. It's just so grand. Everybody just gets taught to love the government. And that's what one of the guys at this meeting said, you know. Been a English teacher for 52 years. And he said that what we do in the education system is we're just teaching them to love government and, you know, think that they're all looking out for them, you know, back in the days of free university. And it produced this very, very complacent population, didn't it? That'll just believe anything the government says because the government loves us.
Well, the government does a lot of things, but it also does a lot of bad things, you know. That's the thing. And if, you know, if it's covered up in the way that it is in Singapore, you know, I mean, what is the value of that perception index? I mean, really. And also, as far as New Zealand goes, well, how bad are these other countries? I mean, if we in New Zealand live in a supposedly one of the best countries in the world as far as not being corrupt goes, those poor buggers in all the other countries, I don't know what they're putting up with.
Oh, my God, you know. Well, it's talking about, like, a cop that you can bribe off the street like you can in Phuket, for example.
Oh, it costs a lot of money here.
Yeah, it costs a lot of serious money. Mm-hmm.
You're very well paid here, you know. And there's certain well, exactly. I mean, certain, like a letter from a senior lawyer who we in this country call a QC, Queen's Counsel, That can often have a lot of weight, you know, and you have to question exactly, you know, what are the, you know, it's not just money, you know, it's also the prospect of further employment and so forth. For example, as I was saying, you know, the New Zealand system is there is only one police force. And if you look at the Policing Act, which I was very much against, and I wrote several blogs against that, you can see that the person who appoints the police commissioner is the Prime Minister, not the Minister of Police, the Prime Minister. And who appoints the deputy commissioners? The Prime Minister. So what if you're a deputy commissioner, right, the only way to get ahead, which is the top job, the commissioner's job, is to do what the Prime Minister says. And that's reality. And we had a case of that, our previous Prime Minister, who now happens to be the, I guess it's the number three, isn't it, in the United Nations?
Yes. And she's, and I was kind of considering well, there's the problem here, isn't there, with scumbags like Helen Clark and the UN in general. I really they've got such a really high image of themselves, don't they, Will? You know? It's like we're gods or something. And feel like they can rule the earth. And the Search and Surveillance Bill just freaks the bejesus out of me, man. It's going to affect everything that we do here.
It's a total big government takeover for all them corrupt mates. You know, it's yeah, it's terrible. And it's part of a global strategy, and it's closing around, you know, most Western nations under different names, but under the same central premise, and that is, you know, believe the terror, believe that all your neighbours are bad, and believe the government's good. You know, just demonising people in general, making us all afraid of each other, and trusting of government, the opposite to what it should be.
Yeah. I mean, what's going to happen to our society when everybody kind of is really afraid of each other and really, really dobs on each other all the time, you know? I mean, when it gets real. You know what I'm saying?
Look at you know, African states that are broken down. There's just lawlessness, and look at Jamaica for a period there. You know, like even Jamaica, sort of 7 or 8 years ago, shooting in the street in central built up areas, in urban situations, rapes and murders and just total. That's what happens.
Yeah. Lawlessness by government. Welcome to the new world order. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And we'll be back next segment with more from Tim Selwyn of Tumeke. Mr. Ban Ki-moon, the current Secretary General, rumoured to be discussing that Helen Clark will be running for the Secretary General role when he ends his term in 2015. And you know what's funny about that is that Jonathan Eisen, editor of Uncensored, who's a good sponsor of the show, he had a bet, a gentleman's bet, that that's exactly where she would end up, at the top of the UN. Okay.
Oh, she'd be learning French right now. She would be learning French right now with that very prospect in consideration. So I think those rumours are true. And also on the point of the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, I hear that our Prime Minister has invited him down to the South Pacific Forum, which is going to be hosted in Auckland in next year. Just before the Rugby World Cup, funnily enough, so he can wine and dine his South Pacific colleagues and impress them with the rugby, which is a very important... I suppose it's the equivalent of... Well, I suppose it's sort of like American football, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, look, I've got an enormous stadium full of men with short shorts and grabbing their balls and grabbing each other, you know? Come over
well,
here.
You're right.
It's a friggin' spectacle.
I'm very interested in it these days. Yeah, well, it is a big spectacle, but he is going to invite the Secretary General down here for that. I don't know if he's agreed to come down or not, but that's his plan, to make it a huge ego event for our Prime Minister, who's also had the big ego event, Vinny, this week of whining and dining and schmoozing the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, when she was down here schmoozing her way around. I don't know exactly what she... Well, people here are trying to work out, well, why is Hillary Clinton down here?
Yeah, what the hell was she doing down here, man? And this comes off the back of, old Barry Satoro flocking on down to Indonesia with this, like, I don't know, 32 volcanoes or something going up. With a whole bunch of bloody warships. You know, there's just this weird stuff going on in amidst, like, the most crazy-ass election anyone's ever seen in the US. Like, massive amounts of fraud going on, you know. And we've been talking about this a lot of late, that the global elite are being exposed by the alternative media at such a rate that they're so freaked out that they need to advance all their agendas very, very quickly, right? Like, we're coming up to critical timing here.
Well, it's a very interesting, yeah. I mean, there's been a whole lot of laws being passed. I mean,
including in fact, Obama has changed the succession laws of the United States. Now, not the vice president, but the secretary general will take over by executive order.
Not the first lady.
No.
Because at the rate she was campaigning, I was thinking, is she second in charge? And in the same way, I suppose, Billary, that's what they call the two who was the previous before the Bushes. I mean, they operate very much as some sort of condominium conjoint rulers. I suppose in the Roman sense, it would be consuls, you know, the two jobs are shared, which I find spooky because when you elect someone, I don't think you're electing their spouse as well. It's a rather odd concept. Certainly in New Zealand, our first ladies or first men in the case, because we have had female prime ministers before, take a very a back seat deliberately and they stay very much out of the media. But in the United States, it seems to be the exact opposite, that they're actually used and actively campaigning for them, which I find a little bit creepy. Myself.
Yeah, it's kind of like a flatting scenario when you're flatting with a couple or something. Right, Tim?
Yes, Vinny. Exactly. Well, the couple is an unbreakable block, really. And the thing is, you know, I mean, when the Americans, I was going to say tick their ballot forms, but they don't necessarily do that, do they? In a diebold sort of a way, they push a button and hope that whatever comes out is actually what they thought was coming out. You know, there's several stories in Utah County, et cetera, that those things aren't actually happening. But you don't vote for the spouse as well. It's not you're voting for, what do you call them, Barry and his wife, his missus.
Yeah, and by extension, their offspring. I mean, did you know that John Key's daughter is Anna? I mean, say her first name and her last name for me, please. Anna Key. You know, you want somebody who's literally been given the spawn of Anna Key to run your country? I don't think so. Just in a divergent sense, of course.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, there's all sorts of... Well, as I say, in Singapore, mate, the family members and stuff, they actually get to run the country directly, which I think is something of an outrage, and it has to be corruption because of those links make their allegiances and their interests contrary to the public interest because it's basically for their own family interests. And unfortunately, we've got that in many countries. And yes, democracies are prone to it as well. Of course they are, but you get a situation like Singapore. I just can't get over that they are co-equal, aren't they, with this country, New Zealand, as being the supposedly least corrupt country in the world. You just look at their stats, you look at the way it's formed, you look at there's not really any free media there. You look at the fundamentals that ought to be looked at, and you're saying this is a highly corrupt country. Oh, yes, it's efficient. Oh, yes, they've got a high standard of living. And the price of that is you do what you are told. And unfortunately, it's going that way here as well, I think. And yes, you're right about the momentum building. You were saying about things being exposed, and that to get ahead of that, these various powers that be have ramped up their attack on democracy and freedom, basically, by, well, legislation, I suppose, is the first one. We've got a whole lot of things going through under the guise of the police force and so forth. We've had this awful spectre, and I think we chatted about it last week, did we not, Vinny, about the Warner Brothers out of Hollywood coming down here, 10 suits, going into the Prime Minister's residence and walking out with a deal that involves not only giving them tax breaks, but changing the labour laws of this country. And not just changing them the very next day. Parliament went into urgency and it was rammed through the House of Parliament. Once again, we've only got one House of Parliament, so it's quite easy to do here.
Hey, and this, hold this on a second, Tim. Was,
yes?
Have in the National Party, in the time that they've been in Parliament, have they ever not rammed something through?
Like, it's in their blood.
It's just the fact that they don't actually want any input from anybody about anything. It is.
Oh, they've had their input. They've had the input from Warner Brothers. Team suits from Warner Brothers have made the law of New Zealand.
They may as well have shown up carrying suitcases full of cocaine, you know? This is so shady.
The spectacle was absolutely outrageous, and there is a backlash growing of this suitcase suit diplomacy where big corporates come in and just make the laws of the country. There is antagonism towards that. And the fact is, though, unfortunately, in our system, they were able to ram it through Parliament all in one go. We are talking about sitting through all stages. This will probably horrify the Americans, your American audience. But we're talking about concocting a law for Warner Brothers. This is to make the two Hobbit movies, which are prequels to The Lord of the Rings. So we're talking about, they estimate about $400 million. I was going to say New Zealand dollars, but at the rate the US dollar is going at the moment, it's probably going to be at parity anyway, right?
It cost $1 trillion, you know, they'll have to deliver it in several wheelbarrow loads a day, you know, as they come it out from the former collapsed Soviet Republic of America.
Well, at the rate they're going, mate, I mean, they're dropping like a stone. They're talking $400 million. So, okay, that's got a lot of swing in this country. There's only 4 million people here. Okay, it means a lot to the Wellington economy, which happens to be the capital where a lot of this production is going to take place. Okay, so what? But to change the labour laws of this country, and what the law did basically was said that anything described as film production, which I believe also includes making video games, now that people who would usually be, or normally under New Zealand law, be considered to be employees of the studios or whoever, are now to be deemed to be contractors. In other words, they lose all their employment rights, they lose their union rights, even though for all intents and purposes, and a court case in New Zealand has proven this, and this is what the government is legislating against, is that that these people are not employees, which of course they are. I mean, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, then I think it might be a duck. But in this case, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, apparently
it's dinner.
It's a giraffe, or it's a rhinoceros, or it's in fact a hobbit. And they rammed this bill through, sitting in the first stage, second stage, and the final stage of reading, all in one go, and it was all over in less than 48 hours without any input from the public, without any input from the unions, without any input from any other, from the producers or anyone affected in the industry. And why? Because Warner Brothers wanted, right, because Warner Brothers had a threat on that they would pull out production, even though they've sunk 100 mil apparently already into the production in New Zealand. So it was an empty threat to start with. And these It sounds like
a staged event to me, Tim. It's too convenient. I mean, how could they draft the legislation up and get it passed in 48 hours? That's too quick. You know, these things happen too fast in politics. I think that the legislation was drawn up well ahead of time and had just been waiting for the right moment.
Well, I would say...
Just like the Patriot Act, been drawn up well in advance.
Well, I would say that the national government, the Tory government, the Conservative government here, it's very much aligned to their way of thinking anyway, so they would have liked to have done that.
Had they at any point proposed similar legislation in the past?
No, they have not. But it was so poorly drafted, Vinny, that there were several changes going through the process anyway because it was... had the look of it being rushed. But that's not to say this is very much aligned to where the national government wanted to go anyway, right? And the fact is, and this is a very sad fact, is that the previous government, who's supposedly of a different political persuasion, the Labor government, also actually went through the process of a select committee, and they did have input from the public, and this was over the copyright laws here and the parallel importing laws. And basically Hollywood got their way again. What they said was basically that Hollywood has 1 year to get their stuff together, and that we in New Zealand are not allowed to parallel import or copy anything coming out of Hollywood basically for a year. In other words, Hollywood can delay things being released in this country for a year now, and milk it for a year. The other thing they did, of course, was with copyright law, which they strengthened, unfortunately for us, was the criminalization of what I believe is civil litigation, which is basically one person copying or whatever or something else. I mean, why is that a criminal act? It's not really. It's actually a civil act. But what they've done is they've managed to criminalize it, which, in other words, first of all, it's the power of the state to impose penalties that corporations could never do, getting to them to do their bidding for them. And secondly, on that theme also, is the police and the enforcement mechanism, getting them to do, the corporations getting the state to do their bidding for them. And unfortunately, Hollywood obviously has got a lot of swing. It doesn't matter which government is in charge here, Vinny. Both of them have yielded to Hollywood. Unfortunately, this current government we have here, the Nats, they are so quick to fold. They are so quick to fold that, as you say, yes, it almost looks as though it was completely pre-planned. And, well, as far as the momentum thing is, I think you're right, Vinny. A lot of these things are being exposed and they are just pouring on the pressure. And all around the world we see this legislation tightening up and cracking down, and I'm not sure if democracy is the right answer, because if both parties are going to do it, Vinny, what choice have we got?
And I think that's a good place to leave it. Thank you very much, Tim, for joining us here on the Vinny Eastwood Show.
All right. Cheers, Vinny. Always good to talk to you and to your American audience as well.
Welcome to the Vinny. And we're back. I was kind of I really love having Tim on the show because he's he's had quite a lot of experience when it comes to being screwed around by the government. After all, he spent 2 years in prison for sedition, right? And when we had dinner at our producer's house, and his wife was going, "What, a sedition in New Zealand?" And Tim's like, "Look, your reaction is my reaction." You know, and he's check it out if you're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show. Will at thevinnyeastwood.com. I bet. get your Ninja Boogie Kung Fu on. It's a bit of sub-focus there. I do like to play the music quite a bit, don't I? You know, maybe talk radio is just a little bit too intense sometimes, and you need some kind of musical apparatus to help relieve that stuff. So, yes, very good show today. I like that. We've had two guests, Chris Van Ryn from Kia Ora Gaza, the old convoy busting through there, and, of course, Tim Selwyn from 2 Mekere, talking about how investigative journalism is going to be hogtied in this country, not to mention every other type of activism under the sun. You know, I just feel like we're going to be ruthlessly enslaved a heck of a lot faster than anybody would have thought possible. Don't you agree, Will? You know, maybe by doing so.
That's a million dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah. But maybe by moving this fast, the government's really shooting themselves in the foot, because I always say the old adage that the way you expose a fascist is you make them act like one, you know? And we've been chatting about the New World Order and alternative media's rising meteorically. To use it metaphorically, and as a result, they need to pass all these laws in order to keep a lid on it. Okay, but it's not going to work, I don't think. You know, it's too late in the game.
Well, it's not going to work for what they want it to work for, because such a problem doesn't even exist in this country or in the United States or Britain. But is it going to work for their purposes, for their covert purposes? Well. Maybe. You say, you know, make a fascist act like one. Well, a lot of people don't know even the definition of fascism or socialism or anything. So, you know, they can act like fascists. And people just say, oh, it's government's job. That's the role of government. What are you, an anarchist?
I was called an anarchist once. That was great. I thought, no.
Just once?
Just the once. I was also called a right winger, and I was also called a communist, and I was also called a libertarian. So there you go. I've been accused.
I guess they're all right, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, I've been accused of being the entire spectrum. You know, which lends credibility to my argument that the entire spectrum is false.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, when I was 16, 17 at school, people were saying to me, since when did you become a right winger? Or you're such a mixed bag, you know? Well, that's because you just shouldn't put all your eggs in just one camp, because, you know, it feels cool to be part of one camp.
Yeah, I want to vote for the person that wins, because then I feel like a winner. What, even if the person who you're voting for is a total loser and they're going to make the country fail miserably? You know, people have got no political discernment these days, do they, Will? You know, it's almost as if thinking about politics and actually understanding the true ramifications behind it just isn't popular enough to spend your attention on.
Well, Vinny, that's not our job. Oh, that's not our job, you know. We just need to get jobs and pay taxes, and that's all citizenry is about, you know. That's all you're meant to do, is just get a job. Get a job, protester. You pay taxes. Look, those bludgers are taking my taxes. Well, the banks aren't, though. The banks aren't printing money hand over fist and devaluing your currency. They're just fine.
Yeah.
Because they're working hard. So because they're working hard, because they've got jobs, they must be good, right? I mean, this is the stupid logic of probably about 1.5 million New Zealanders would think like that. Really, really, really stupid.
You know, and think about it. You know, where's your sources of information coming from these days? I mean, if you're listening to the alternative media, the likelihood is you'll probably get some idea of what's going on. And I'm not saying we've got the whole picture here, because, that would be pretty frickin' arrogant, quite frankly. But people who watch mainstream media think that they are getting the whole picture. And it's just so hilarious. Goodness sake, you know?
And then they think we come across preachy if we disagree with them, but they're always preaching to me, these people. Always like, oh, did you see this show on 60 Minutes? It was so excellent, you know? And it's just some controlled debate. It's just some nonsense, you know? You know, they're the preachy ones. but it's not. It doesn't seem preachy to them because everyone else is in agreement. So if you preach common propaganda, it's okay. If you disagree, hey, expect the fire.
Well, that's the Delphi technique, which we talked about with our special guest Pam Killeen yesterday on. Basically, of the whole oneness of mind, and basically what you find out is that if too many people agree on something, anybody who stands up and disagrees and actually tries to sound reasonable and look at both sides is told to sit down and shush, because then you're a dangerous person. You've got original thought. Oh, God, we can't have that.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and it's a frustrating thing for you and me because, you know, people will say that we're opinionated and you're like, well, you know, to a certain extent, yes, they're right. But unfortunately for them, we also have a look at facts, unlike them.
What's wrong with forming opinions from facts rather than forming opinions from their gut all the time? You know, there's nothing wrong with a bit of gut instinct, but they're just total, oh, my gut instinct says Barack Obama's a friendly man. He's got nice white teeth.
He's tall and handsome like a leader should be. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. And we'll see you again tomorrow with a heck of a lot more of our great ranting and ravings and opinionated, factless, of course, stuff. See you, folks.